Antioch, or one of those large cities, as the center of Christian faith, except for the Jews. It was simply impossible, as Paul said, for them to coexist.
As far as the early church, the early opposition,
well, this was not just, this was not mere opposition to this one. This one is simply the impossibility to operate. The first bishop of Jerusalem, you know, James, they threw from the top of the temple. So, actually, looking at it, you might say prophetically or anticipating the future. In not too many centuries, Islam came along and swept over Asia Minor, so that, in fact, the Christian world that was in the East, and it was, as we know, the Eastern Christian world, became enslaved, really, by the Muslim overlords, to a point where it became a state church, and ever since, of course, has been quite unauthentic, at least by Roman Catholic standards, Christianity, I'm speaking of the Eastern Church, dominated first by the Muslims, then by the Russian czars. Meaning, in other words, that there was in the East an opposition from the very beginning, which the apostles see like the death knell of Christianity as they were saved.
Do Peter's epistle shed any light on the reasons of the
Yes. He does say a good deal about the opposition to the faith, and specifically of the Jews. He, by the way, identified himself as writing from Babylon, which was the then symbolic term for Rome. This is Peter. So, also, the need for some kind, well, he insists upon authority and the need for some kind of structure. Now, this, of course, this is by implication. The most direct evidence that we have to the reasons why Peter went to Rome occurs first in the letter of Clement around 95. The third successor of Peter, in which he points out the need of having a center of Christianity in what was then the center of the world, geographic and cultural center of the world, and the fact that by coming to Rome, Christianity was spared the debacle, which has always, since the very beginning, oppressed the church. In fact, all religious ventures in the East. Like starting a religion in California. Chatham, I understand, one every 24 hours, a new one comes into existence. All right, now the succession, therefore, by implication, means that the bishops of Rome, both historically and then it is further believed, even by divine guidance, chose Rome, which was the center of the civilized political world, as the center also of Christian world. The papal primacy is an extension of what we saw when we took up the Petrine primacy. By definition, primacy means the exercise of authority in matters of faith and morals, and indeed not just authority, but supreme, primal authority. When we examine papal infallibility, we'll see more clearly what implications are in matters of faith. But in general, the evidence, therefore, that needs to be found for the existence of this kind of papal primacy should come, first of all, from the scriptures, then from tradition, and then, as we might say, from reason, by examining the character of the church that Christ was founding. What I'm giving you practically is Bellarmine's argumentation. The Council of Trent had defined the papal primacy. Papal infallibility was, by implication, in Trent. It was defined specifically by the First Vatican Council. Why did Bellarmine take it up? For the obvious reason that it was challenged. On, as we could quote from any number of Reformed documents, the crucial test, you might say, of whether or not Catholicism is valid was whether the papacy and papal primacy is valid. If, in other words, the claim that the primacy is authentic, then the Catholic Church is authentic. Because it was instinctively felt that by the acceptance or rejection of the papacy, you are or are not a Catholic. In Scripture, the papal primacy is evidenced by the way in which, first of all, Peter exercised, as we saw yesterday, exercised his authority over the other apostles. Not merely over the faithful who were immediately under his charge, but over the other apostles. There was both a deference to his person and a respect for his authority, which was unique among the apostles. Just within the scriptural period, and one of the soundest evidences that Catholics find for the papal primacy in the first century comes from a famous letter that we just referred to a moment ago of Pope Clement I. Remembering that he is still writing within the apostolic age before the death of St. John, who died about 98. It illustrates something that, again, a Catholic finds satisfaction in discovering, documentation which is certainly authentic, of the exercise of that kind of primal authority on the part of a pope during the lifetime of the apostles. Problems arose in Corinth, and you remember the difficulty that Paul had with the Corinthians. They were in many ways a speculative people, also by temperament, you might say, insubordinate, given to all kinds of, at least by Greek standards, vices. At any rate, the difficulties arose in Corinth over the holders of certain sees who had, as a matter of fact, been appointed by the apostles. Clement, a perfect stranger, that is, personally, to the Corinthians, sent messengers to the Corinthians with a long letter, which is certainly authentic. There are two letters, by the way, of Clement. The second of which is dubious. The first is certainly authentic. In which he begins all the way at the beginning of the human race and outlines the bad effects of envy. And he finally ends up by saying, and it was envy that caused the death of Christ. By the way, that letter is well worth reading, even as a modern commentary, The Vice of Envy. It was through envy that Cain slayed. It was through envy, well, even before that, that the evil spirit tempted our first parents. It was through envy that the prophets were put to death. It was through envy, finally, that Christ was crucified. And consequently, he berates those who envied the authority of the existing bishops and told them to behave themselves, to practice Christian humility, not to envy those, because even though in many ways they were perhaps unsatisfactory, or at least not very likable by the people, nevertheless, the bishops were appointed by Christ, and therefore they were the authentic holders of the office. But the significance is this man Clement, who was Bishop of Rome, should have done this. In other words, writing to people who were such a great distance away, Greeks, moreover, who in general, as you know, did not particularly any respect the Romans. They didn't love them. They may fear them, but they did not love them. Nevertheless, as far as we can tell, when Pope Clement wrote to the Corinthians, the schism was settled. It was, historically, the first great exercise of papal primacy within the apostolic age. Yes?
Did he claim to be the successor of Peter?
Yes. He appealed to the authority of the apostles Peter and Paul, as he said, and he appealed to his right as the Bishop of Rome. Yes. Now, as we go through history, from the first century on, the first we've just mentioned, we find two kinds of evidence for the primacy. The first, you might call it theoretical, and the other, perhaps, factual. On theory, from the very beginning, all the extant documents that we have, whenever they touch on the nature of the church, beginning, as a matter of fact, with Ignatius of Antioch, whom we quoted before in 107, on through the early apologists, particularly Justin. Then once you get to the end of the second century, there's just a mountain of documentation in which the See of Rome and the papacy is regarded as having a special authority and prerogative in the Church of God to preserve the faith as Peter preserved or was told by Christ that he would be prayed for, that he, keeping the faith, would be able to preserve the faith of his brethren. So correspondingly, the See of Rome, following in the footsteps of Peter, was spoken of as having authority, which was recognized, as I say, at the end already of the first century. And appeals, this of course now becomes factual. Problems that arose already in the first century and then Ignatius at the end of the first, with the Gnostics. Then through the second century, the various sectarians that arose, especially those that were somehow affected or impacted by Judaism, wanted to compromise between Christianity and Judaism. Toward the end of the second century, when the Christological errors came up. And finally, working our way into the late third and beginning of the fourth century, with Arianism, in each case, the one appealed to was the Bishop of Rome, just to cite a number of historically authenticated instances. In the middle of the second century was the famous Easter controversy, about which some of you have heard. The Easter controversy had to do with when the date of Easter would be celebrated. In the East, the Jews being so dominant, they also affected the Christianity of the East, making it in many ways more Jewish than Christian. And among other things, symbolic of their Judaizing tendencies, they would celebrate Easter on what corresponded to Good Friday, and would in general follow the Jewish calendar, and quite ignore the custom of the Christian church by then of celebrating Easter on Sunday, and on a Sunday which was distinct from the Jewish feasts, which was the first Sunday after the first full moon in spring, and not following the strict Jewish calendar. At any rate, the popes didn't like it because it looked like a cleavage between the East and the West. In itself, rather insignificant. The day that you celebrate a feast is not so important, but the meaning behind it was important. Instead of celebrating in the sense of rejoicing, they would practice penance. They would fast. They would wear somber clothing. They surrounded the whole feast of Easter somehow with that which was not characteristic at all of the Christian faith. And in fact, they were told to conform to the West. And the one who told them to conform was the Bishop of Rome. Several bishops were involved. Anicetus was one. And at the beginning, they simply ignored the papal mandates. When they realized that this was getting serious, they sent delegates from the East, no less a man than Polycarp, a great bishop of Smyrna, who had been a disciple himself, had been a disciple of John the Baptist, John the Evangelist. They sent Polycarp all the way from the East to Rome to expostulate with the Pope, pleading with him, that was by that time Victor the First, pleading with him not to excommunicate, as he threatened to excommunicate the Eastern Christians, for not conforming to the practice of the Western Church as dictated by the Church of Rome. Polycarp persuaded the Pope to allow this thing to ride. After some time, towards the end of the second century, another hassle, another Pope, this time Irenaeus, came into the picture from the other side, and again pleading with the Pope, don't excommunicate these people. They will conform, give them time. So he did withhold the excommunication, but all the while the fear of being excommunicated by the Bishop of Rome. Well, the thing was finally settled, actually, by his withholding excommunication, and by the Council of Nicaea, by 325, the Eastern Church celebrated Easter when the Western Church did. then, again, to typify the exercise of papal primacy, we have the famous case of Cyprian. Cyprian, as you know, was a bishop in northern Africa, specifically in Carthage. In 10 years, everything happened in his life. From a pagan, he was baptized, he became a priest, he became a bishop. He got into a long controversy with the papacy, and he was martyred, all in 10 years. At any rate, the conditions in Carthage were such that a schism broke out, not unlike what we saw. Did we see this on the Donatists? I think we did, didn't we? The Donatist schism. Pretty much the same business, the same place, controversy after controversy. In this case, a man by the name of Felicissimus, the most happy one, was the rival to Cyprian for the See of Carthage. And there were two bishops there. So, can't have two bishops, that is, rivals. One can be auxiliary of the other, but they cannot be two competitors in the same see. One could be Methodist and the other Catholic, but you can't have two Catholic bishops. Consequently, both appealed to Rome spontaneously. And Rome said, Cyprian is bishop. So Cyprian became bishop. But then after that was settled, a more crucial problem arose where Cyprian himself came into conflict with the Pope. We have no less than 81 letters extant that seem to be authentic. Pardon me. Most of them are authentic. There are some that are dubious. The issue arose over something that the Donatists later on created, namely whether or not those who apostatized really lost the faith in such a way that they would have to be rebaptized. Number one, if they wanted to come back. And secondly, if those who had sinned and, say, formed a church of their own or purportedly lived as Christians, whether when they baptized, their baptism was valid. There were two questions. Whether the heretics or the apostates should be rebaptized on coming back to the church, and secondly, whether the baptism of those people was valid. Cyprian held out basically for rebaptism. Rebaptism of those who had apostatized, rebaptism of those who were baptized by those who were not Christians, or at least were not professing the faith of the Christian world. The Pope, especially Pope Stephen, told Cyprian to change his mind, that it was not true that a person like that had to be rebaptized, because baptism by anyone is valid. And once baptized, you cannot, not only may you not, you cannot be rebaptized. In other words, the effects of baptism are permanent. In the course of this controversy between Carthage, with Cyprian there, and Rome, with the Pope, an excommunication was on the way from Rome to excommunicate Cyprian. Fortunately, for his own benefit, he was martyred before the excommunication reached him. And he is commemorated in the canon of the Catholic Mass. Cyprian, invoked as a saint. But it came within a hair's breadth of being an excommunicate apostate.
Did excommunication take place?
Did it or would it?
Was there de facto excommunication?
No. No, there wasn't. No, you don't excommunicate a dead man.
No, I mean the fact that he'd been excommunicated, just merely the message of excommunication that had not
No,
been.
No. Because he would have to, and he could, first of all, explain and defend himself, and also, faced with that, the likelihood was that he would have said, okay, if you, I don't like it, but I'll go along with it. The point is that Cyprian, who, by the way, this should be added, Cyprian by this time had become head of all the bishops of North Africa. And he was having all kinds of synods with bishops. And they all said, Cyprian, if you think the Pope should be resisted, if you think the Pope is wrong, you argue him. You argue him down. But the concern was always to convince the Pope. They were all convinced that rebaptism was necessary, but they were uncomfortable. And this long correspondence between Carthage and Rome further illustrates the position that Rome occupied, say, by the end of the second and beginning of the third century. Then, again, a dramatic case. These, by the way, are just picked out of numerous instances of papal primacy being exercised way before the Council of Nicaea. The famous case of Tertullian. Now, the man, we may have met him before, was one of the most learned, if not the most learned man of his time. Tertullian, in many ways, shaped ecclesiastical Latin. He had been a lawyer before he became a Christian. He was a convert. He wrote many famous books in defense of the church, the most famous of which was the Apologeticus, which means the apologist, the defender. Beautiful, incisive, clear. Well, he fell on bad times by getting into an error called Montanism. Now, apart from all the things which the Montanists held, they were rigorous as far as the church goes. They claimed that only certain kinds of people should belong to the church, and certain kinds of sinners could not be forgiven their sins. Particularly, forgiveness in modern times makes you see how far we've gone or come. Murder? Apostasy? Adultery and fornication. First of all, the church had, from the beginning, been extremely strict on remitting these sins, only after prolonged penance. Some cases, a lifetime. And it's no wonder, then, that the church produced the martyrs that it did in the first centuries. In fact, if it hadn't didn't have this kind of people, you wouldn't have had the martyrs. So there's a providential relationship between the great demands for sanctity in the early church and the church's suffering and withstanding the persecutions. At any rate, while saying that certain sins, these for example, were very grave sins, had to be expiated with special public penance and so on, nevertheless, the church never held they were unforgivable. The Montanists taught they could not be forgiven. At least the church had no power to forgive those sins. And by the way, the whole concept of confession, the whole question of going to confession, is way back at the end of the second century already. Because you just don't go around telling people you've committed fornication or adultery. I mean, there are some people, for example, in the state asylum, who, being exhibitionists, might well do a thing like that. But no sane person does it. He may be immoral, but as long as he's sane, you don't broadcast your crimes. The point being that precisely because these things were confessed and had to be confessed indicates the confession was completely in possession by the second century, which is not unwell to know. The point is that even crimes, secret crimes, as for example apostasy or adultery, were claimed by the Montanists, and Tertullian became their leader, that the church had no jurisdiction over them. You could pray, you could ask God, you could hope, and you would die. And you could hope that you would wake up on the other side and not in hell. But you had no assurance. So Tertullian, he was rebuked by various bishops. He was finally dilated to Rome, and he was told by the bishop of Rome to conform. Cornelius happened to be the man at the time in Rome, told Cornelius to buckle down. Tertullian said he couldn't, he wouldn't. And he wrote some blasting diatribes against, as he called, the Church of the Harlots. Look at the kind of people they've got in the church. It was not so. And he was right. He was right. In other words, that there had been, the early church had, and even the modern church, of course, always wants holiness. On the other hand, as the numbers increased, you might say, by the sheer law of probability, the possibilities of people coming in who would be weaker in nature and consequently could well even commit such crimes. Could they be then reinstated in the church? Cornelius said they could. Tertullian says they could not. Tertullian wouldn't give in. Cornelius wouldn't give in. So Tertullian was excommunicated. And Augustine writes at length about Tertullian, describing what happens to a man who resists the authority of Rome. The greatest genius of his time, going about spending the last 10 or more years of his life, as Augustine says, wandering around like a madman. Nobody would listen to him. He simply was discredited in the eyes of the Christian world, ultimately because he resisted that authority which told him, you're wrong. You're going overboard in the direction of moral rigorism. Then we have a whole series. This, by the way, is a course by itself. Obedience. It's a graduate course. The first 3 centuries of papal primacy is a graduate course in theology. But the 2nd and 3rd centuries were beset by all kinds of Christological controversies. Who is Christ? What is he? And the early Gnostics, as you know, had him one of the aeon. They were somehow impacted by Oriental thought and deity upon deity. And Christ was not the true God, but he was some kind of intermediary. Yeah, the Zoroastrians have some of this. Not God, divine in the sense that he is some kind of a Superman. Then, in the early centuries, there were those who simply denied that Christ was God, or who made him, perhaps God indeed, but denied him a real human nature. And you have, and the names are immaterial. At any rate, all through this period of controversy, almost 2 centuries, Nicaea in 325 was almost 150 years after the controversies had begun, in fact, more than that, 200 years. So Nicaea came, you might say, at the tail end of all kinds of controversy as to who is Christ. In the meantime, these cases, mainly emanating from the East, were regularly submitted to Rome. Not everybody, of course, conformed, but those who did not were automatically put outside the church, and we have some pre-Nicene Arians, or at least those who denied Christ's divinity, who were excommunicated and ceased by that token to be members of the then existing Christian church. Finally, we have Nicaea itself. Now, it is true that Constantine had a lot to do with summoning Nicaea. I mean, he saw the problem which beset the world that he ruled or governed. He realized that a theological issue had disturbed the peace of the empire, and he figured, we've got to do something. So he did exercise his authority in summoning the council. Well, frankly, who else could possibly have summoned the council in the shadow of, remember, this is 325. The church had just come out of the catacombs in 313, where there wasn't a single ecclesiastical structure, mind you. This is not easy to realize. A single ecclesiastical structure that was built to stand above ground until the beginning of the 4th century. I don't say there were not meetings above ground. What I'm saying is there was no overt external profession of Christianity until, of course, the persecution ceased. And consequently, the only one who could possibly have summoned the bishops would have been the emperor. Nevertheless, way before the summoning of the council, we have historical evidence, particularly in Eusebius, regarding the discussions between Constantine and the Pope, and 2 papal legates, we even have their names, who were sent to Nicaea to direct the proceedings there. So in other words, there is a papal hegemony which is recognized already in the first council of the church. When Arius was condemned, as you recall, the dramatic question put to him, he has, you know, claims that Christ was the first of God's creatures. And yet he wrote in such a way that it was ambiguous and sometimes uncertain just what he had. So he was asked very simply, do you say, answer yes or no, do you say there was a time when Christ was not, that he in no way existed? Then 220 some bishops raised their voice, see what he would say. And he answered, yes, there was a time when Christ in no sense existed. That settled it. Then, of course, he denies Christ's divinity. Because while Christ as man had a beginning in time, as God, he is co-eternal with the Father. So, as far as history goes, in this, Bellarmine supplied to his contemporaries what I've given you, and much more occurs in Bellarmine's treatise, De Pontifice, De Romano Pontifice, on the Roman Pontiff. Now, reason. Really, the reasoning behind it, and I'm still following all I'm giving you, frankly, in this whole business on the papacy. When I go outside of the scope of Bellarmine, I make a comment on it. In arguing to the primacy from reason, we don't mean, obviously, reason alone, because we're dealing with a premise which is founded on faith. But given a church which is intended to be, as Bellarmine said, a perfect society. Now, by perfect society, he didn't mean that everybody in it was perfect. That's obvious. Or that everything about the church is perfect. That's equally obvious. But perfect in the sense of finished. Perfectus societas. The word perfect in Latin means completed. Perficere means to finish something, to complete it. Given, in other words, a society, therefore, which is perfect in that it has, or is intended by its founder to have, all that it needs to operate without essential subordination to another society, which in this case would be the state, then, unless it had ultimate authority, it would be self-destructive. In fact, it would be non-existent. Because by definition, every society, by definition, comprehends subjects who are obedient to lawfully constituted authority. Now, that's all the primacy means. That in this one man, he is vested the ultimate authority. Now, the question of whether this authority should be democratic, aristocratic, or, as Catholicism claims, monarchical, that, for that, you've got to go back to the scriptures to see what Jesus did, whether he told all the apostles. Now, every once in a while, you get together, you discuss things, and you reach conclusions by, say, majority vote, or, as he did, chose one man, or history in delineating the development of the Christian faith shows that it was not a conclave sort of church with a Congress that would vote, debate things, and the majority would vote. But always, ultimately, one man. Well, given a society, and given this shape of the society, which is agreed to by both scripture and history, Bellarmine concluded, either you have the primacy, or you don't have the church. And the question really arises, see, in what sense, except semantically? Now, words can be used in so many senses. As you know now, and this is, I think we reached an all-time low in lexicography. You know that, in 1962? With the new unabridged, Webster's unabridged? For the first time in the history of the English language, the Webster's unabridged, and they defended themselves. They've written learned articles. The whole introduction to the Webster's unabridged says, We believe lexicons are not to be normative, but merely reflective of the speech of a nation. That's the nadir of you name it. Because it, well, just to indicate anyway, that you have no, there's no, language is no longer, what you find in the dictionary doesn't mean this is what you should say. No matter what inconsistencies, for example, ain't and all the other curiosities are in there now. You can never, so at least Webster says, you can no longer appeal to a dictionary to tell you what you should say. All the dictionary tells you is what is being said. So enough people say something, it's going to get into the dictionary. So what we'll have, of course, is annual supplements to the dictionaries. Well, but given a society of any kind which has normative procedure, which determines what's supposed to be done, not dictionaries, don't have, of course, any legal standing, but any society does have and supposed to have. The whole question is, and the answer really by this standard is no. Unless there is authority in the church, no matter what you call it, it's not a church. Unless you define, as the Reformers did define or redefine the church, in terms of some kind of invisible entity, by which God calls all the predestined. And then, of course, you have a church, quotation marks, but it's no longer the ecclesia that was spoken of, say, over the centuries by the fathers, who always recognized a people that were distinctive from others in the same civilization. Or not people in infallibility. I want to finish this. We go to 8, can we? Do we?
Well, before you leave, you put scripture up there. You mentioned scripture.
Oh, yes. The Acts of the Apostles, man. The exercise of the papal primacy by Peter, or the exercise of his primacy, rather, by Peter, and then the continuation of that by his successors. The business of papal infallibility, surprisingly, was treated at great length by Bellarmine, even though that was not directly attacked by the Reformers. But Bellarmine shrewdly recognized that unless you defend infallibility, you can have the primacy all right, and you can say the church has jurisdiction and the Pope ultimate authority, but specifically, when it comes to a matter of doctrine, and the crucial test in the Reformation times was doctrine, in a matter of doctrine, do you trust, or may you trust, one man to settle a doctrinal decision? Now, in many ways, Bellarmine was centuries ahead of his time. Why? Because up to his day, there had, of course, been exercises of papal authority by just the popes individually. Nevertheless, in most of the big crises, doctrinal crises arising over the centuries after the 16th, there had been general councils summoned, councils of the church. And consequently, it could well have looked as though whatever authority the Pope has in matters of authority in general, in other words, telling people what to do, disposing of bishops, cutting up territory, and so on and so forth. But when it comes to that crucial question of doctrine, what is a Christian supposed to believe? Historically, it would have looked more logical to see the councils of the church are the ones who are gifted with infallibility, and that you don't ultimately trust just one man to pass judgment in matters of doctrine. Because doctrine is too complex, too profound, requires too much of a background and all the rest. Why did he undertake to defend papal infallibility? He undertook it because the Reformers, especially Luther, regularly in their writings appealed to a council over the Pope. Now, for this they had a tradition that went back to the 13th century in France called conciliarism. And Luther, as early as 1521 already, in his speech to the English princes, appealed to a council. And of course, he and his followers would be part of that council. They would vote, debate, then a conclusion would be reached. Now, the arguments of those who were in favor of conciliarism had this much to say for themselves. First of all, it is true that in many of the crises, councils were summoned. And the popes did not, now notice this, did not what, by implication, papal infallibility says they might have, settled the question all along. Why didn't the then reigning pontiff settle the problem regarding Arius? Why summon a council? Why Chalcedon? Why Constantinople? All down the line. Why a council? If the Pope alone can do it, why bother with everybody else coming? Why a conclave? So there was that one. Secondly, the feeling was, and it was quite strong, that where the popes passed judgments, they passed judgment, and this was especially in France, from a vantage point which is in their favor. They will be swayed, especially, say, by national and political interests. Remember, we are talking about a period in which there were the papal states and all the rest. And that is a consequence. National interests would not be consulted unless bishops from each nation were represented. Now, Pelham defended papal infallibility in various ways, and I should, before we, I have to break up for a moment, or more, 10 moments now, but Pelham's doctrine of papal infallibility was the basic source which the First Vatican Council used to define infallibility. A classmate of mine from England, by the way, Father Corboy, was teaching at Heathrow in England, and both of us were interested in Bellum, and I was writing on one subject, he was writing on another, and between the two of us, we got our dissertations published, but he published his dissertation on the role of Bellum at the First Vatican Council on papal infallibility. And practically everything, all the argumentation, all the principles, and the issues that are now being created through perhaps a misunderstanding of papal infallibility were found in Bellum. So we'll continue with that and finish up, I hope, getting to the laity before the class is over. We have a 10-minute break, and I am... It does not mean, first of all, that the Pope has any powers to communicate God's revelation as though he we see as a revelation from God. So there's no revelation from God. No new revelation from God. As recently as a couple of years ago, I was teaching at the University of Detroit, and a young couple came to the university there, wanted to talk to somebody. I happened to be available, and they spread a number of books on the table, and one big book right on top was, Is There Salvation in the Catholic Church? Very interesting book. The answer was, of course, no. No Catholic can be saved. And the basic argument, among others, was that Catholicism, under the aegis of the popes, had perverted the Gospels by bringing all kinds of new doctrines of which you don't find a thing in the Scriptures. And the man who wrote the book must have had at his disposal a copy of this book, which is a collection of all the definitions and declarations of the Church over the centuries, neatly summarized in 800 pages, fine print. And he had the exact numbers of where, for example, the Immaculate Conception and other things were defined. So first of all, it's not revelation. Secondly, it is not even a divine inspiration, in the sense that a prophet would receive an inspiration from God and that a pope hereby inspired. It's not a divine inspiration. It is most emphatically not impeccability, as though he cannot sin. That party needs arguments. That means popes can and pathetically do sin. But what is it? It is a very restricted and carefully refined function. It is a protection. A divine protection which the church believes this one man, when speaking as head of the whole church, has from God, not to make an error in anything which has to do with faith, that is belief, or conduct. Now, one more point, which is somehow connected with revelation. Now, this can be missed, and yet it is this which I think is crucial in this whole controversy or in this whole discussion. Somehow it has to do with revelation. Now, it's true that among the areas of papal infallibility are things which do not look ostensibly like having to do with revelation. But actually, the purpose of papal infallibility, as Bellarmine was at great pains to point out, was to preserve that very faith which the Reformers said they want pure. The purpose of that infallibility is just that, to safeguard the Church from that from which it is expected that God would safeguard her if, and there's the big hypothesis, if God did communicate to that Church, a body approves. If he didn't, of course, everything is up for grabs. But if he did communicate teachings which he wanted conserved, he would, in his wisdom, have somehow provided for that conservation. The only question is how. Well, he would have provided for that conservation consistent with the nature of the society he was organizing. If then the society which he organized was authoritarian, as having someone who was at the head of it, you would expect that head to determine what or what is not revealed and what God wants us to believe. One more point regarding that infallibility. So far is it from being anything you might say super added to what the Pope naturally has, that it can be looked upon, and normally is, God's providing, his providentially arranging things in such a way that the Pope will not declare something which is wrong, so that all kinds of ways are open to God to keep the Pope from making a mistake. The simplest, of course, is by having the Pope physically disabled so that he cannot, just doesn't feel right, or he dies, or you name it. A comparison that I like to use when I teach this in theology is, and this is a very apt comparison, I would say a father and his little boy on the beach during the summer, and the father says, well, whatever you do on beaches, but suppose he was preparing a meal for the family. And the young kid is out scampering near the water, 3 years old. And the father always keeps an eye on this youngster to see how near he's getting to the water. Well, as long as he sees he's far enough away from the water or running parallel to the shore, the father keeps putting around the grill, maybe roasting, or whatever he's doing. But if he notices the kid is getting too near the shore, then he'll pull him in by his pantails and on to safety on shore. Now, the Lord, as it were, keeps an eye on the church. And as long as things are going smoothly, after all, there's plenty of machinery in operation, see? And there's no likelihood of an error being pronounced, fine. In other words, it is not the kind of direct charismatic inspiration that even, say, the writers of the Gospels received, where God had positively to step in to make sure that what he, God, had in mind, the hagiographer would write out. It is the barest minimum, you might say, of divine guidance. But without that, so it is believed, or its equivalent. And the next question, the very simple one that Bellarmine asked, those who question the authority of the Pope. And by the way, it should be said, see, by this time, among other great exercises of authority, which the popes as individuals had exercised, was the classic one of Leo X condemning Luther, and condemning him at that time as teaching heresy. Which means that by his definition, the Pope, that is, he was equivalently teaching infallible doctrine by Catholic standards. If he did, as he selected, among others, five major propositions from Luther, among which, by the way, was one that the Pope is not the successor of Peter. And the Pope took it upon himself. In other words, he was not going to wait for a council, which incidentally took 25 more years even to get going. Something had to be done quick. And Leo X, who was not a paragon of virtue, but he recognized there was danger. And anyway, this had to be clarified. Now the point of issue is that if the popes do not enjoy this infallibility, this is Bellarmine's, you might say, closing argument. If the popes do not enjoy infallibility, pray tell, who does? And if you've got a substitute, fine. Let's have it. But you've got to have somebody deciding among human beings. And God, if he is behind this church, will provide. Now the rest, without going into details, the First Vatican Council, as you know, further refined the doctrine. It refined it in such a way as to particularly distinguish two things. Distinguish the relationship of the council to the Pope. See, that was not clear in Bellarmine's time. There was a sense in which the Pope was superior to the council. But it was never quite clear, at least not clear enough, whether, see, even when the Pope makes a declaration which, say, is purportedly infallible, whether he has got to wait around until the bishops decide to approve or confirm the Pope's teaching, or does he have to consult them beforehand? And the Vatican Council settled, this is the First Vatican, this is 3 centuries, roughly, after the Council of Trent, 250 years after Bellarmine. No, on neither case, neither count. The Pope neither has to wait for the bishops to tell him in what direction to define, nor after having defined, does he have to wait around until they approve. As, by the way, had been done in France for centuries, to be exact, for 600 years. The popes in Rome would cast all kinds of definitions. You name them, they have them. See? They came to the borders of France. They were met by a courier who had promptly dispatched this to the emperor, or, as the case might be, to the parliament. They would discuss it, debate it, if they liked it. Okay, it can be promulgated in the fair country of France. If not, they would send it back to the Pope. At any rate, on that count. And secondly, that is both a question of the relationship of the council to the Pope, and secondly, the scope of infallibility. That had to be refined. This is by the Vatican Council, First Vatican. We are now jumping ahead of ourselves, that is, ahead of the specific area of our coverage. Nevertheless, it is of great importance for the ecumenical movement. Why? Because the First Vatican Council did clarify things which have since become, well, somewhat crusty, in the sense of rasping for some people who feel that the Vatican Council, First Vatican Council, made or decreed certain intransigent positions which make it difficult for us now to find that kind of Christianity which we want? Well, the answer is no, but it has to be explained. The scope of papal infallibility was extended to include not only things which were immediately matters of revelation. During Reformation times, that was unquestionably the immediate issue. How many sacraments are there? What is a sacrament? What are the effects of baptism, and so on? All of which clearly deal directly with revelation as such. But by the time of the First Vatican Council, a great historic event had taken place. And if we were taking another course, we would include this at great length. The event of Jansenism, which, as I think we mentioned, was it in this course? It must have been in the other. The Jansenius, although he lived and died as a Catholic bishop, he was a Catholic Calvinist, and not even in disguise. He was just a Catholic Calvinist. He was a Calvinist who wore Episcopal robes. He taught straight Calvin. In fact, he was clearer, more incisive, more profound than Calvin. Now, in the Jansenist controversy, which lasted over 100 years, and emanating, by the way, from France, from Belgium, but mainly from France, the question came, and it was a showdown, which Bellarmine could only vaguely anticipate. Yet, he already laid down the grounds for this. And the First Vatican Council used Bellarmine's distinction as to the scope of infallibility to decide the Jansenist controversy. In fact, if it happened, France would have been lost to the Catholic Church. What was the issue? The issue was whether or not papal infallibility extends beyond things which are immediate revelation. I mean that are directly God's spoken word as found either in Scripture or in sacred tradition. Bellarmine said, no, infallibility must extend beyond things which are immediate revelation. The Pope also has authority, he believed, even though there had been no historic exercise of that power, mind you, until Jansenism. He has authority to define infallibly things which are not immediately God's revelation, but which, if they were not settled, would somehow subvert revelation. Now, this gives the Pope very broad powers, in case you don't know. For example, he can define infallibly, the validity of his own election. That's right. Is that of some moment? Suppose someone comes along now, and by the way, today is the anniversary, as you may know, of Paul the VI, the election is Pope. Suppose somebody now comes along and questions Pope Paul's valid election. There's just no Second Vatican Council, or at least it's just a big conclave of a lot of bishops with the steamship and airline companies making a lot of money, but nothing happened in Rome unless Pope Paul is Pope Paul. Now, his election as Pope has nothing to do with the revelation. There's no reference to that anywhere in the Bible. Yet, unless in a showdown, he would have the authority, the power, to declare infallibly that I, Paul the VI, am Paul the VI. Unless God, in other words, protected his church in case of dispute or doubt to know what or where is the truth, even factual truth, what would happen? You name it, anything. Now that's what happened during the Jansenist controversy, and Bellarmine laid the framework for it. Under the Jansenists, the issue was whether or not Jansenius, Cornelius Jansen as he called himself, had written and taught five propositions which the popes had repeatedly condemned. Among which propositions were such as Christ did not die for all mankind, but only for the predestined. Unquote Calvin. Requote Jansen. Or grace. He is irresistible. You get it, you're saved. You don't get it, you're lost. Who determines whether you're going to get it? Of course, God. When you get it, you don't resist. Or, there is no real freedom except freedom from coercion. There is no inside freedom of choice in matters religious or spiritual. Well, five such propositions, just a moment. The popes have repeatedly condemned those propositions and said they were heretical. They were not tenable by Catholics. And all the while, it was implied that Jansenius had taught these things. So what did the Jansenists do? They wrote very pious letters, and bishops of France wrote to the popes and said, "Of course, Your Holy Father, Your Holiness, we condemn what you condemn. Who would ever dream of teaching that? You just happen to be mistaken in thinking that Jansenius ever had those in his writings." So they went along continuing teaching Jansenism and giving lip service to the papal definition on these five propositions. What finally had to be done? The incredible thing had to be done. The Pope had to exercise. The whole question was, did he have the authority? Had to exercise infallible power, defining not merely that this is not authentic Catholic teaching, but that Jansenius, naming him, taught it, number one, that he taught it in a particular book, Augustinus, which he identified, and that, most incredible of all, these propositions are being condemned in the same sense in which the bishop intended them when he wrote them. That's getting inside of a man's mind. But after almost 75 years of controversy, it got to that subtlety. And so it happened. In fact, the Pope did define very just a single sentence, but that sentence was crucial. That is the dividing line between papal infallibility as understood before and as understood since. Why? Because it is an implicit recognition that within the Church, the Catholic Church, as vested in the papacy, is a power of infallibility that extends literally to anything which is believed to be necessary to safeguard the faith. The result of that, as you know, was France remained Catholic, a certain number of people fell away, a number of bishops didn't go along, and they, by the way, were the ones who founded what is now called the old Catholic Church. And these people have never forgiven the Jesuits for their part in the Jansenist controversy, because they had a lot to do with clarifying the issue, using Bellarmine as, you might say, the instrument of clarification. We could say much more. Let's go on. I think we have a question or two. Then.
This went through my mind when you were talking about.
It is the next, am I correct? Mm-hmm. Is that the next section in our? Mm-hmm. Is it? Now, at this point, we take up an issue which is extremely broad in its implications, and for modern ecumenical work is indispensable for some clear understanding. Why talk about it? Well, because, and using Bellarmine again as the leader, it was really one of the crucial issues of the Reformation. For all practical purposes, erasing the distinction between clergy and laity, if you will, laicizing the church or clericalizing, you have your choice, it doesn't matter which you make. Perhaps more accurately, it would be removing the laity. So that, strictly speaking, technically speaking, it is Catholicism which believes there is a laity, because by implication the laity are distinct from those who are not lay people. Secondly, in terms of the ecumenical movement, it is, I think, this speaking now for Catholics, of great importance to recognize that